Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Vancouver, Burnaby Mountain. My name is Chris Spangenberg and I am the producer of this series of interviews you are about to listen to. Now this is the last episode in this series of traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, and traditional Chinese medicine community here in Vancouver. In the course of these interviews, I examine the local culture and practice of traditional Chinese medicine, as well as inquire into its philosophy and difference from Western medicinal practices. This series is produced for CJSF's 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. Today's interview is with Dr. Bill Hardman, an acupuncturist, public spokesperson, and political leader of Chinese medicine in Vancouver, who has served as president of the Acupuncture Association of British Columbia, the Canadian Acupuncturists, and the Qualified Acupuncturist and TCM Association of British Columbia. Bill was instrumental in having provincial legislation enacted to raise the standards of the practice of acupuncture and simultaneously protect the public from unqualified practitioners. Bill was also one of the first practitioners qualified under the BC Health Professions Act to use the title of Doctor of Traditional Chinese Medicine here in Vancouver. In the interview, we first discuss his background and how he discovered and eventually pursued Chinese medicine and the vocation of healing people. Afterwards, Bill talks about his experiences studying Chinese medicine in the Canadian College of Chinese Studies in Victoria. Following that, we talk about his experiences working as a president of various Chinese medicine associations to promote and lead the profession, significantly by educating the public. Bill then expounds about how other activities in his life prior to his interest in Chinese medicine allowed him to naturally incline towards a leadership role in the Chinese medicine community. Next, we discuss both the changes and policies that he effected in these organizations as president. We end the interview talking about Bill's vision of unity in the Chinese medicine community of Vancouver. My name is Chris Spangenberg, and you are listening to an interview between me and Bill Hardman here on CJSF 90.1 FM. So, Dr. Hardman, tell me a little about yourself and your history.
I grew up in Ontario. I came to British Columbia as a young man, and leaving Ontario in February with ice and snow and arriving in British Columbia to green grass and robins, I decided this is where I wanted to live.
For how long have you been practicing traditional Chinese medicine?
Just over 25 years, not including my year of internship during my training.
How did you end up working with traditional Chinese medicine?
I actually was introduced to Chinese medicine through my former wife when she used it to stop smoking. And that triggered my interest or my curiosity, I guess. At the time, I was working in air traffic services with Transport Canada. And I had several days off between my shifts. And I found out that there was a school or a college in Victoria. And I traveled down to Victoria from the north end of the island where I was working and monitored some lectures and came to the realization that that was really what I was looking for in my quest to help develop my healing talents that by that point in my life I recognized that I had. And after investigating it further, I decided to leave my government job and go back to school as a mature student and study traditional Chinese medicine.
What benefits do you see in Chinese medicine?
The biggest benefit is it can be either it can be used to help people recover their health, and where it really shines is as a prevention. although as a society, we are very much reactive as opposed to proactive. Although in the time that I've been practicing, I've noticed a gradual and positive shift. More and more people are becoming slightly more proactive in their approach to their well-being.
What led you to become a doctor?
Primarily my interest in helping people. In 1975, I had quite a serious individual injury, and Western medicine was very proficient at putting me back together, I guess you could say. But then they, other than offering me medications with very strong side effects, they didn't have any real, what I would consider, natural solutions to what I wanted to accomplish. And in investigating different modalities during my personal healing experience, I realized that the holistic approach was more natural and a more positive move. And I felt that since I was given the opportunity to pursue a profession where I could help others, that it was part of my obligation or duty as a human being to help others to accomplish their health to whatever level that they personally choose. You know, some people are more, again, more proactive than others, and some people like their misery, and that's okay. as a healer or as a doctor, we always have to respect the individual's approach to what they want out of life. We can encourage them to make good choices and provide them information so they make informed choices, but the bottom line is the choice remains theirs.
When you were younger, how exposed were you to Chinese medicine? How common was Chinese medicine in your local community?
I don't remember as a young person ever even seeing a Chinese individual. We didn't even have Chinese restaurants in the area that I grew up in. It was very isolated. The exposure that I had as far as healing goes were some of the old nature cures as far as working with things that were available. And I wasn't even in a hospital until I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, because at that time, home deliveries were very common when I was born. And it was all basically natural remedies versus running out to the local drugstore.
Where did your passion for helping the TCM profession begin?
That's a good question, and it's a difficult one to answer, because I just felt that the public needed to learn more about it, because it's not a natural part of Western culture. We had to educate the public to its benefits and how it could best serve them as far as maintaining their health.
Where did you do your study of traditional Chinese medicine?
At the time when I took my training, there was very limited opportunities in Canada. In the early 70s, because of a landmark court decision that found acupuncture to be the practice of medicine, one school that was located in BC at that time moved to the States, where it was more accepted. And when I started, there were basically two reputable colleges, and both were located in Victoria. And I looked at the curriculum of both colleges, and I opted to take my training through, at that time it was called the Canadian College of Chinese Studies. The dean of the college, Dr. Tan, he was a double doctorate, theology and biochemistry, which initially might sound like a strange combination, but in his case, he made them blend very well and really helped us in our studies and our curiosity about Chinese medicine.
Could you describe your experience studying Chinese medicine? How was the curriculum, and what were the expectations at the time?
The curriculum was very comprehensive. The underlying concept was, first of all, heal the healer, in the sense that if we are going to be helping others with their health, we need to be coming from a very well-grounded position on our own part. And The other part of it that was difficult in for some of my classmates, more so than personally, was letting go of the hardline scientific background that some of my fellow classmates had. And in saying that, I'm not putting down science. I believe in it, at least when it's used in a positive way. And I found that of my classmates, those who had the most difficulty getting in touch with their own personal problems were the ones that had the greater difficulty in getting through the curriculum. Someone asked me once what I learned most about, and my answer was myself.
Could you talk briefly about your experience studying under Dr. Hong Zhu?
He was an incredible professor, and he was very gentle. His spectrum of knowledge about the traditional Chinese medicine was very comprehensive, and he had a way of just putting it across in a very easy way of understanding. And I remember one day he gave our class a list of 100 acupuncture points and told us to memorize it, and told us that if we knew the four factors involved with each of those points, as far as the neurovascular, the anatomical position, the primary function, and the innervation in the area of the point, that we would never have any problems.
In your life, you have served in various official capacities as president of the Acupuncture Association of British Columbia, Canadian Acupuncturist and TCM Alliance of British Columbia, and the Qualified Acupuncturist, as well as the TCM Association of British Columbia. Could you talk a bit about your experience working at such high levels to promote and lead the TCM profession?
It was something that I just sort of came into it in a natural way, because at previous times, I think the first time I remember being in charge of an association was when I was in grade school. I was elected president of my local 4-H club, and we had to learn about how to repair tractors and farm equipment and stuff like that. And during my time in sport parachuting, I worked quite extensively with the National Association there as a safety officer, a technical and training person, and I spent several years as a chief instructor examiner for the National Association. So when I moved on into traditional Chinese medicine, it was just kind of like a natural thing that occurred. My first involvement was as a student member back in the late 80s, when we were working with lobbying, starting to lobby the government as far as getting regulated. And I remember one weekend, a couple of my classmates and I spent our weekend faxing in a list of petition signatures. I think it was all together, it was about 6,000 pages that we faxed to the health minister of the day. And keeping in mind, this was long before we had computers and some of the other electronic equipment that we have in our everyday life today. When I got started, it was with the Acupuncture Association of BC, which was one of the first, if not the first, associations in the province. And it was a matter of working with the profession on a volunteer basis and providing whatever skill set we had available to us at that time to work with the profession and educate the public. And this is something that's an ongoing thread all the way through my other positions, was to make the public aware of the fact, the strength of traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture and how beneficial it can be. And unfortunately, we are still one of the best kept secrets in town as far as its healing potential.
What were your responsibilities as president in these capacities?
Of course, there's the leadership role, because you are sort of in charge of the other volunteers and encourage them to work to the best of their ability. And because it is a volunteer service to the profession, you have to respect the fact that people have their individual lives as well as their practice, and that any time that they spend volunteering is time that they take away from their family and their other life activities. I think the biggest thing with being in that position is being a good listener and realizing that everybody has a valuable opinion as a leader. Even though you may not always agree with other people's opinion, you have to listen to it and then make suggestions that will have a more positive outcome.
What challenges did you face working as president of these associations?
I guess since I don't speak Chinese, that was one of the biggest ones. Although I found that I was quite well accepted by the Chinese community. So language was probably the largest problem, although as I inferred, the Chinese people were always very accommodating and they were very helpful as far as making sure that they translated conversations for me and things like that. And one of the other underlying situations is that even though there is a huge Chinese population in Canada and more specifically in British Columbia, although a lot of the Chinese people have immigrated, they haven't really integrated into the society. And it took a bit of gentle persuasion, I guess, to make people realize that they were now living in a different country with a different set of rules. And whether they liked it or not, those rules of their new home were the ones that we had to follow.
Did you ever face any criticisms for not speaking Chinese at such a high level?
Probably there were some people that were had their reservations. We used to have some fun with it occasionally, and as you probably know, the Chinese society is very exuberant, and I don't think that too many of them have ever read Robert's Rules of Order. That was a one aspect of it, managing the meetings that we had in a way that allowed people to voice their opinion. If there was any dissension as far as me not being able to speak Chinese, it wasn't presented to me directly. I just accepted the fact that I had the insight of being able to lead them in the right direction, even though I didn't speak the language.
You talk about any changes you made to the TCM practice and profession during your time as a president of these associations?
I think I helped them develop their organization in the sense of figuring out how to best deal with some government situations. And that was something that I learned over the years that we spent attempting to become regulated as a profession. And also my background in working for the government, it gave me some insights as to, you know, how to deal with different situations in regard to getting the government to understand our side of the discussion. And there were challenges. However, from my background in sports, I realized that you can't be a winner every day, and you just have to learn from the times when you don't always accomplish what you want and learn from those experiences and move on.
Were there any new policies or way of doing things that you introduced during your time as president?
Probably the biggest thing that I have always worked on is unification, in the sense of attempting to bring everybody together. And unfortunately, what happened, this is going back a long ways, with the Acupuncture Association of BC, they set very high standards for their qualifications of a member, even though this was in the pre-regulation days. They adopted basically the same standards as the state of California for qualification. And what occurred is when a person immigrated, if they were wanting to join the association, they had to prove their capabilities through a written test that the association had. And some of the Chinese practitioners that took, offense to that in the sense that they felt that they were already qualified and they didn't really need to cooperate with a volunteer association to do what they wanted to do and felt they were qualified to do. And as a result, several of these individuals started up their own associations, and it really slowed down the development and progression of the profession in the province, because instead of having one strong united voice, we had all these little factions. And it reminds me of that old expression about the man who would be king. It was quite disruptive in a lot of ways to the overall development of the profession in the province.
What were some significant events or high watermarks during your time as president?
One of the things that we really strived for was continuing education. And as an association, one of our major events is that we participated in the Pacific Northwest Oriental Medicine Conference, or Chinese Medicine Conference. And we hosted that on a couple of different occasions. And we had attendees at this conference from basically all over North America. And one of our earlier members, Dr. John Stan, he has continued that on as a private enterprise. And he has an annual conference of Oriental medicine every spring. And he brings in very high-level presenters from all over the world that helps to elevate the level of skill set that the average practitioner has in the province. And we, as an association, under the current association, that's one of our key focuses as well. We offer our members a minimum of 25 hours of good quality continuing education every year, which is free to members. And this helps them meet the requirement of our regulatory college, which requires us to have 50 hours every 2 years of continuing education.
What was your vision during your presidency?
I wanted to see all of us become united, because there's strength in numbers. And the more you are scattered into smaller groups, the less effective we can be in lobbying the government and having the benefits of Chinese medicine accepted into the mainstream medical system within the province. So if I had to narrow it down to one thing, it would be to get everybody on the same page and all steering in the same direction.
And that was an interview with Dr. Bill Hartman, a doctor of Chinese medicine and political leader who has served in several official capacities of numerous TCM associations. In the interview, we talked about the responsibilities and challenges that Bill faced as president, as well as the changes, and significantly, Bill's vision for unity in the Chinese medicine community. This was also the last episode in this series of interviews with Chinese medicine practitioners in Vancouver. These interviews will be broadcasted again in May for Asian Heritage Month. They will also be available on SoundCloud in the coming future. Updates will await soon, and hopefully over the next few weeks you'll find them on SoundCloud. I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in and listening to these interviews. I invite everyone out there to explore the beautiful and efficacious healing tradition of Chinese medicine. Acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine are a growing trend in Vancouver, and I personally believe that they are not just a trend, they're definitely here to stay, and these long-standing traditions are finally gaining recognition not only in the scientific community, but between the public, people like yourself and I. And there's no better time than now to get to know this medicine better. I hope what my series has sort of demonstrated is that there is a thriving community of Chinese medicine here in Vancouver, and there's no better time than now to undergo a treatment or get some herbs or even talk to a practitioner, especially with all the regulation going on. Do your research, explore the Taoist principles of balance and harmony, and check us out. Anyway, thank you very much for listening.
This is Bird Note. In 2018, paleontologist Daniel Field wanted to know more about birds from the end of the age of dinosaurs. He took a closer look at some specimens from an amateur fossil collector in the Netherlands. Daniel and his team used micro CT scanning, kind of like a high-energy CAT scan, letting them visualize the encased fossils without the risk of damaging them.
We were absolutely amazed to see that concealed completely within the rock was a near-complete, three-dimensionally preserved skull of a small bird from the end of the age of dinosaurs. And this just completely blew our minds. This animal was alive in what you can think of as a geological blink of an eye before the asteroid impact.
This is the earliest known fossil record of a modern bird. The tiny skull, just under 2 inches long, looks chicken-like in the front and duck-like in the back. A possible common ancestor between the two families. So Daniel and his team named it the Wonder Chicken.
So it's very plausible to reconstruct the Wonder Chicken as having been a relatively small-bodied, long-limbed, shore-dwelling bird, something like a sandpiper in the present day.
This nondescript, quail-sized bird that walked along the Cretaceous shoreline may have had an advantage over their tree-dwelling relatives, who went extinct when the asteroid wiped out their forest homes. And for that, it truly earns the title.
My best and most healthy relationship snuck up on me. I was in my late teens and started the relationship thinking I'd have a summer fling and maybe learn a little bit about dating in the process. I told myself, I'll dump him in September when school starts again. And then I ended up falling in love with him. We were together 5.5 years. Since then, I've had a string of relationships where the driving force was passion. It starts out strong with a blast of wild intensity and an all-encompassing fervor, but they end up being emotionally unavailable. I wanted to know what was happening and found some answers in attachment theory, which is research on the types of people we're attracted to and what happens when we get together. After delving into the attachment research, I started to purposefully date people who were better for me, but this came with much less excitement and passion. I found the process a little discouraging and a bit overwhelming. Dating like this was new territory. I became interested in doing a story on dating differently. I was curious about how this worked for others. And then I happened to bump into Mark at a party. He had gone through something similar, and he was willing to share his story. Mark and Eileen were set up by a couple of friends, and it was a bit awkward at first.
It was kind of a strange thing. It's, when your parents tell you to talk to their friend's kid, it felt a bit like that, kind of a forced conversation.
As Mark will say, he felt obligated to talk to me.
Regardless, they ended up staying up most of the night and even took in the sunrise together. But it wasn't an instant connection. They went out a couple more times, but they didn't really pursue each other. After some prodding from friends on both sides, they start to date a bit more consistently.
In the beginning, I have to say part of it was that I kept thinking to myself, Mark's kind of crazy and he does all these wild things, but like he has very down-to-earth, lovely friends. And that was kind of like a stabilizing factor where I was like, you know what, I'm going to like see what's going on with this guy. Because I felt like he had some great characteristics. We had a lot of fun together. We had some stuff in common. But there were certain things like the lack of commitment and other things that would drive me a bit crazy.
Things like Mark finding it hard to commit to any plans with Eileen in case something better came along. Or about how she'd barely see Mark when they went to parties together because he'd be off socializing and only realize he hadn't spoken to her all night when she'd find him to say goodnight. And these were the early days, where you might expect just the opposite.
It was like pretty early on, like it must have been at like about a month or something, and I just said very casually to Mark, how do you think things are going? Which I thought was like a very normal question to ask someone that you had dated a bunch of times and seen a couple times a week for a month. And he like took this long pause, and then he was like, well, I'd say I'm about 60% into you.
In my mind, I tend to think in terms of, I guess, too much like an engineer. And so